when I die, my hard drive is just getting trashed because I have so much incriminating evidence from these podcast outtakes on like so many people.
90% of those from me.
I'd say 80%, but only because you've just got more recorded hours than anyone else.
Welcome to The Writer and the Critic, a monthly podcast devoted mostly to speculative fiction books, reviews, and whatever else takes our fancy. I can't say speculative properly.
Why not?
I don't know.
Oh.
I'm Kirsten. Ballarat's warmer this time.
Ballarat is warmer today. Are we really going to start with weather again?
I just think it was such a such a focus of the... I'm certain I introduced the podcast last month. Because didn't I go straight...
No.
I'm pretty sure I did, because I went straight into the weather. I think we've stuffed up. It doesn't matter. We've done it now.
Did you ever listen back to them?
I try not to.
No, yeah. Continue.
Okay.
That will get cut out,
no,
just so you know.
The
Don't
weather,
tell me how to produce.
Yes. The weather in Ballarat's great.
Oh, God's sake.
So, hi Kirsten, how are you?
Hi, and I'm good, thank you.
It's a glorious day, don't you think?
Oh, yes, it is a glorious day. We're heading for a top of 30 degrees in sunny Ballarat,
yeah,
with
which
a
is
chance
in,
of showers
which is,
tomorrow.
Which is what in Fahrenheit?
I don't know. I never learned
it's
Fahrenheit.
The,
I've been Celsius my whole
it's
life.
Late 80s, early
I'm pretty
90s.
Good with inches and feet, but I'm completely crap at Fahrenheit
because right, so
I never 30, ever learned it.
What's 30 degrees in inches and feet?
You're an idiot.
Yes.
Continue.
You made a horrible error in the last podcast that you're now looking to fix. It was an astonishingly bad error. One of those errors that, you know, frankly,
I really
I can't believe you get up in the morning.
Oh, my God.
So can you now correct it? Thanks.
You're an idiot. Okay, it was not an error. It was a blind spot exacerbated
a
my...
cultural blind spot.
No, a geographic blind spot. So, no, I did say that the Karen Tidbett book wasn't currently available in ebook, and that's true if you live in Australia. We can't get it. But, of course, you know, unless you're doing some jiggery-pokery with the internet, it's difficult to often see outside your location. But we have had a couple of people report back that it is available on as an ebook from Amazon UK, I believe. So it may be available wherever you live in the world, depending on what rights have been negotiated. So that is good news. It's good to hear that at least some people in the world outside of Australia can grab the ebook legally if they wish to. And that was Jagannath by Karen Tidbeck. So yay for you guys and
boo for anyone.
Still feeling very sad for us Aussies who may have a harder time acquiring that book.
Yeah.
But, you know, there's geo blocking, so there's that. So what are you doing this month, Ian?
We're doing two books, both set in Nigeria. Do you agree with that statement?
Yes, I agree with that statement. Yes, I think that's irrefutable.
Irrefutable. Okay. Those books are Lagoon by Nnedi Okorafor and Rosewater by Tade Thompson.
I think we can probably talk about them together because they are, clearly there's similarities
we chose
in theme.
Because A, they're set in Nigeria.
But more than that.
And B, they're both first contact quasi-alien
invasion novels.
Novels.
So I think it's actually quite interesting to compare how they treat that.
One is was inspired by District 9 directly, as in this is a response to District 9. Not inspired as in I love District 9.
And which one was that, Ian?
That was Lagoon.
Yep.
Rosewater is not necessarily inspired by, not all Nigerian science fiction novels are inspired, or Nigerian set science fiction novels are inspired by District 9.
No, of course not.
But it's indefinite, as Gary K. Wolfe would say, indefinite conversation with the genre that it is based on.
Oh, absolutely.
On. And they both are, actually, not just Rosewater. So, well, you've got on the list here starting with Lagoon. So we may as well start with that and then drag
sure.
in Rosewater as the case may be.
Sure, okay.
And well, as you've read it more recently than I have, because I don't reread the books for the podcast, and that, and I'm just saying that out now. And I'm going to cut
yeah,
this.
We know that.
So
we know you don't reread. You've said it like every time you've had a book you've already read. You say, I haven't reread this because I don't do that.
I remember none of the plot, but I remember my emotional reaction. No, I do remember the
dear.
Plot. Keep it. You've got the book there, so you can read the book.
Okay, I'll just read.
Sorry, the back cover copy.
I'll just read what it says on the back of the book. A star falls from the sky, a woman rises from the sea, the world will never be the same. Three strangers, each isolated by his or her own problems, Adiora, the marine biologist, Anthony, the world-famous rapper, Agu, the troubled soldier. Wandering the beach outside Lagos, Nigeria's capital city, they're more alone than they've ever been before. But when a meteorite hits the ocean and a tidal wave overcomes them, these three people will find themselves bound together in ways they've never imagined. Together with Ayodele, a visitor from beyond the stars, they must race through Lagos and against time itself in order to save the city, the world, and themselves. Dun, dun, dun.
So this is a book that I
Which is really good.
What, the book? Or
cover copy, actually.
So it's called cover copy.
I don't know. Okay. Well, it used to be called flap copy because on books had dust jackets and it was on the inside of the front. Can we just... Everyone now calls them a blurb. Let's just go with the changing dialect and say the blurb, even though blurbs are actually the quote given by other people about the book. But it's all now just blurb shit. So the blurb shit on Lagoon is particularly nice.
Which is rare.
Can we not have this conversation again about what that's called?
Well, you know, we've only done 60 podcasts in about 7 years. So
yeah, I think we've had this conversation 10 times.
Probably. So, Lagoon is crazy bugfuck. For me, in a great way, because it is both an alien invasion first contact story.
Mm-hmm.
It is also a superhero origin story for the characters.
It is.
It is also mythic Nigerian come alive throughout the narrative story. And it's also a story entirely about change and renewal, in a sense. It's about Lagos or Nigeria using this opportunity because the first contacts happened there, not elsewhere.
Don't you find that the first contact happening in
at a country not
outside
America.
Of North America,
or an English, or even a white country, or whatever,
to be really refreshing. White country,
that's not good, but yes, it is refreshing. Yeah. So, an opportunity. Although there is this is a dramatic novel. So there is an army, and there is a. There is a confrontation with the army, etc.
And with other people who are either pro or against.
Yeah, so there's a religious movement. See, I remember stuff from the book. Etc. So there is obviously conflict.
Yep.
But when the president is made aware, he takes this as an opportunity not to take advantage of, but to promote and elevate his country.
Yeah, absolutely.
Which I thought was also refreshing.
Yeah.
Because usually the people in government in these books either capture the alien and dissect them. Or...
Which some people wanted to do, in Lagoon.
Yes, but didn't. But then this is a conversation with that sort of story. So, of course, it's going to take into account some of those aspects, but then undermine them totally. So, they want to dissect them, or... They want to take advantage of their power.
Yeah. And
use it for their own nefarious.
Yeah. And I mean, I think not all Western books, but overall, I think we'd largely can say with some accuracy that the Western tradition of first contact, alien invasion, alien contact, us invading alien planet type novels, all of that tradition usually does treat the aliens with a measure of suspicion, distrust, and often in the genre for good reason, as it turns out. It is refreshing to even though those elements are in the book, it is refreshing to have from a top down perspective of government, not this immediate, we must capture, kill, study, destroy, etc., etc. Because I think that is a huge part of the tradition of these novels in the West, for various, I think, political and psychological reasons.
It's also an inventive novel in that it never sits still for about more than one page, I think. It opens up essentially with, is it through the eye of a squid or an octopus?
Swordfish.
And swordfish. I knew it was some form of aquatic.
There are a few point of view aquatic creatures.
Correct.
The first
so
one
our
is
point
the
of view
fish.
Jumps. There's first person. There's third person. There's point of views of animals. There's point of views of people. There's point of views of gods. There's that amazing bit where the highway essentially becomes sentient.
Yeah, the bone collector.
The bone collector, yep. And takes her.
And actually, like, the whole, when you...
To an extent, it does feel like about 6 different novels in one book.
And I was going to say, at one point, it becomes the narrator of the book, the narrator of Nagoon, becomes clear, and the narrator of Lagoon is actually a god.
Yes.
So the spider storyteller.
Yes, that's
deity.
Right.
So actually, the entire book you're reading is the stories as collected by this entity.
Yes. So in a sense, it has a consistent narrator, but not a consistent tone or voice.
No, I disagree with that. I think it does have a consistent tone of voice.
Do you think so? Maybe I'm saying it wrong. Yeah.
It's just that the revealed narrator doesn't... not revealed until later in the book.
You're right.
The point of view shift.
There's a lot of shifting.
And the points of view shift within scenes and within chapters.
But then it makes sense once you realise that your narrator is your omniscient third person.
Yeah, it is literally an omniscient narrator. But I think I think Okorafor handles that very well.
I can hear a butt coming.
No. There's no butt to this because I think she genuinely think she handles it.
Because you don't like POV shifts, it's more within scene though. I know.
We're going to have this conversation.
No. All right.
Okay. I dislike point of view shifts when they're badly done. No, because she does it in scene quite a lot. She will tell you what one character's thinking, then what another character's thinking. I dislike point of view shifts where you have intensive point of view. And it's usually done badly in third person because that's when it's slipperier for the author to do. And I dislike them when they're breaking the point of view structure of the book that's been set out. And it often happens when there's information that the author needs to get across that can't be gotten across in the chosen point of view, and they have to get it across somehow, and you get a little head slip into some other character or something like that. When there's a genuinely omniscient narrator and when there is a voice of the book that is narratorial, that goes through the whole book, then you're not head hopping. You're being told a story and you're being told what different people are thinking and feeling, often concurrently, but that's how the story's being told.
So it's when the book doesn't necessarily present itself as third person omniscient, where it's really third person personal, or is that how it's described? And then just starts jumping around, that's right.
When there's no clearly defined or presented narrator of the book who doesn't have to be someone in the book.
Yeah.
Like a truly omniscient narrator, as well, except that in Lagoon, I guess the narrator becomes part of the book, where often a narrator isn't. They're not real. They're not present. They're never there. They're just the voice of the book as it's being told, not to be confused with the author's voice. But often,
and I don't want to belabor this, but
that's what I'm saying.
I've just seen this with Universal Harvester by John Darnielle, where it's mostly told in third person, but a first person aspect pops in every so often. You go, okay, what's about this about? And then, yes, it is. I'm not going to spoil that.
Yeah, at some point.
It does resolve as why that is occurring. So it's not just, I thought I'd have a fun and be subversive with first and third person.
I've got absolutely no objections to skipping around in point. Well, actually, I do. So here's the thing. This book doesn't skip around in point of view. The point of view of this book is that of the omniscient narrator.
Who just happens, because they are literally a god, they have the ability to get in the minds of animals.
Because they're omniscient, they are telling you what people are thinking and feeling, and often why they're thinking and feeling it.
If I'm not mistaken, never in the mind of the alien itself.
Possibly.
Okay, anyway.
I've sort of derailed it,
so just keep going.
You're talking about Iodeli is Iodeli? Yeah. No, we never get from her mind, I don't think. But that's what I mean. So it's not skipping point of view, it's presenting point of view, because you're never embedded in any one character's point of view.
Yep.
And the reason why, in general, I dislike it when an author who's not quite as skilled with handling omniscience as some are, and when they do skip around, and when you're in an intensive third-person point of view and then they skip suddenly just for a paragraph to someone else and then you're back, is because you've, as a reader, you've formed a connection with a voice or voices, if there are several points of view in the book. And in this book, you form that connection with the narrator of the book. So it's when that connection is abruptly severed and thrown out for like a paragraph or half a page, and then you're thrown back in.
Those are your rules.
I'm explaining to you cognitively why that form of sudden and unexpected detachment whatever connection you've made with the book, whether that's a connection with the point of view of a character in the book, if it's a first-person narrator, for example, or whether it's with the voice of the book itself, whether that narrator appears in the text or not, and usually they don't if they're an omniscient narrator. That's the connection as a reader that you make, and that's a connection that engages you with the text and pulls you through the text. So the more that is severed and the more clumsily that is severed, and the more that engagement is broken, the less engaged you are with
the book. Should we take that and cut and paste it into the next 30 to 40 podcasts?
Every time you ask this question. Yes. Yeah.
Okay.
Record scratch. Yeah. Insert this. Record scratch. Back to live.
Okay. Good. So, Lagoon.
Lagoon.
And it's also, for me, it's a book about essentially the old gods meeting the new gods in a society, the new gods being this alien contact,
okay,
but also the superheroes that are going to form as a result, you know, our three protagonists and their superpowers. So it's interesting, and this is that, it's not a passing of the torch, but more a joining of these of an older mythology with a brand new mythology.
Yeah, no, that's fair. Look, I'll be honest straight up. I didn't, for all of I just said about engagement, I didn't actually connect to either of these books very closely, and I can't even really explain why. I may have just had a bad reading month.
Should we just end the podcast?
No.
That's passive aggressive, isn't it?
Oh, my God. Well, I'm sorry, Ian, that I didn't love these books as much as you did.
I love these books.
You want to just talk for the next 90 minutes and I'll sit and drink tea?
No, I'm really interested to understand why. It's me, it's not you, doesn't count as
no,
literary
I
criticism.
Think, no. But I think, I think it is, like, it's both, because it's also the book, because it's just, you know, we didn't connect. So with Lagoon, I think it's partially what you just said. You've got all these different threads wound together, and, well, you know how I feel about superhero shit. So there was that. It's like, oh, God, superhero.
Oh, yeah, but it's subtly done in this book. It's not...
I know, but it's still...
wait a moment, this is an origin story.
Yeah, but once... And then my interest flagged a little.
But that's in the last third. Okay,
I know.
Keep justifying.
It was... Fuck off. So it was that tagging around a little. I just didn't connect to the book because, like I said, while I don't have any like readerly objections to omniscient narrators, it's not my preferred voice of a book in general, and I do find it harder to engage with a book that isn't immediately connecting to character. So that was part of it. But as I said, it's extremely well done. It's just a personal preference in points of view and notorial style. I don't exactly know why. The other thing is, and it's really silly, and this is totally me, I'm really not so good on the anthropomorphic animal stuff.
Oh, but that's...
And I know it's me, it's completely me, but...
And in fact, you would have read that swordfish story...
I did. And as a contained story, it worked. As an opening to a novel, it just bounced me back a little. And that is purely me. That's me. I just don't do anthropomorphized animals and animals
I do remember,
the way humans
I do
think
remember,
and all of
and
that
this is a,
stuff.
This is a long time. We've known each other for a long time. I do remember you once telling me that I think you were at a writer's workshop. Or something like that.
Something like that, okay.
And someone was reading this story out, and the revelation in the story is, and it's a cat.
And it's a cat. It's like, oh, fuck.
And I think that's possibly what set up your hatred of these things.
I don't know. I used to like them when I was young. I mean, I loved Watership Down. I haven't read it for 30 years, but, you know, I did like those books when I was...
Yeah,
like,
but maybe it's all those stories that end with, and it's a dog!
And it's a dog.
All of that time,
well,
that was a dog.
I mean, Lagoon doesn't do this. You know from the first paragraph, this is not a human underwater diving or anything. This is a fish or an aquatic creature. I don't know if it's specified when it's a swordfish, but so it's just, and that was just as for me as the opening chapter, it was like, okay, so I'm not quite connecting there, let's continue. And I don't know, I just never, I like intellectually, I appreciated so much about this book, I just didn't emotionally connect to it.
What about Nigeria itself? Because one of the key threads between the two novels, not just the setting, but especially in Lagoon, because it's so much a response to District 9, which is not set in Nigeria, District 9.
Which I haven't seen for so long.
Neither have I. Yeah. But it's set in South Africa.
So I can't remember
and it's
too
a commentary,
much about it.
As we know, pretty on the nose commentary about apartheid and that sort of thing. But
really? I never picked that up.
Yeah, neither did I.
But oh, my God, revelation.
But from memory, its villains, or one of its villains, are a gang in the ghettos, I think, that are Nigerian.
In the shanty towns, I think.
Exactly, that are Nigerian. So,
I think so, yes.
And I really should have done research before I started speaking, but let's just assume that's correct. I'm going to say it confidently. They're Nigerians, those people in that shanty town in District 9. And this book is saying, well, hashtag not all Nigerians. But also, you know, it is its own country. It has a vibrant, you know, vibrant. Is vibrant a word now getting as bad as exotic?
I don't think so. Okay. I hope not.
All right. Because we're running out of words. But it is a vibrant culture all of its own. And it has, you know, ups and downs like any culture does. You know, so there is corruption in Nigeria. But it isn't all just about either running gangs or doing, email.
The 419s.
The 419s. It's not just about that. Yep. So you've got Adiora,
yep.
Who's one of the, you know, three? There's three characters. You had your rapper, you had your soldier, and who I really, really related to quite a lot. She's from America, but she's come back, and there's this whole thread for her about how people always want to leave Nigeria, but they always come back as well. And to me, that
and Lagos in particular,
Lagos itself is special,
yeah.
And that to me is what was so interesting about the book, because it then ties into what the president does, and it is about saying this is a complicated place, like any country in the world is a complicated place, and it's very easy to stereotype a country like this because all you see from Western Shores is the 419 scams and a couple of, and you hear about the corruption and possibly, you know, religious
and
issues.
Violence. Yeah.
But really, there are people who leave, but there are people who want to come back. And actually, there's another novel that reminded me of this, which was Blackcast by A.E. Gowney Barrett, which I read last year, which I didn't particularly like.
Mm-hmm.
It's a sort of take on Kafka.
I think you mentioned it before.
Well, I did think about doing it for this podcast this year, but I didn't like it enough. But it's a take on the Metamorphosis, which essentially a young Nigerian man wakes up to find out he's white. That's the beginning.
Instead of a beetle.
Yes. Right. Yes. Although he has a black ass.
Okay. Oh, yeah. You have mentioned this book before.
So, and there are reasons why I didn't like the story, but again, also says Nigeria, you know, it's more than just the 419 scam stuff. It's a complicated place, da-da-da-da-da. And, of course, we know that intuitively and intellectually that other countries, you know, that aren't in the Western world especially, are more than just the turmoil we see on TV. And that's what this book is so good at. And actually, so is Rosewater.
Yeah, and I think both books have a fairly strong political thread running through them, especially Rosewater, in terms of, the politics in Nigeria, but also the politics of colonialism and post-colonialism and the politics of how the continent of Africa and countries within it are viewed by the West.
Yes.
I mean, just the fact that both books make a point of saying, wow, first contact in Nigeria, this is unexpected.
Well, in Rosewater, it's interesting because in Rosewater, the first contact's actually in London. Burrows into the earth in London, but it doesn't really...
It doesn't hang around.
Yeah. It does its biodome thing in Nigeria.
That's right. The actual kind of where the entity stays and where meaningful contact and transfer and engagement is made is in Nigeria.
And Tade Thompson's Nigeria is possibly not as optimistic as Nnedi Okorafor's Nigeria.
I think Thompson's world is not as optimistic.
No,
as
also,
Okorafor's.
To be fair, set into the future.
Yes, so set in 2066.
Yeah, and 2055. Because it jumps around.
Well, the backstory is,
earlier, 30, 40 years in the future. So it's not as optimistic. Mm. But again, it's multifaceted because that's what countries are like. That's what cultures are like. And there's more than one potentially religious denomination. There's more than one political party. There's more than one way, a view of how to do, you know, and you've got indigenous versus non-indigenous. You've got the whole gamut. And that's why I loved these books, because
on that backbone, on that structure, they both then put on what I believe to be a wildly, got to stop saying words like that, wildly inventive genre story / bit of world building. I think the world building in Rosewater in particular is fantastic.
Yeah, no, it's really
astonishing,
is.
Actually.
It really is.
You'd argue with Lagoon, it's just crazy paving more than world building. It's
yeah, well, I mean, I guess.
But it's drawing from a culture, and I keep saying mythology, but for some people, it's a religion. Yeah. It's not a mythology.
And the thing is, Lagoon is set nowish.
Yes.
So the Lagos and Nigeria and the world in this book is what we have now. So this is kind of like, what would happen now if aliens came? It's not set, you know, 50, 60 years in the future, like the Tardy Thompson book. So in terms of, like, the technology that's available, the way political structures are, all of that, this is what we have. So the Okorafor isn't – and that's not the purpose of the book. And it's interesting to have – it's always interesting to look at a First Contact novel or something like this that is set now. So we're extrapolating about what would actually happen right now in our current state of things, in our current political – atmosphere with our current technology, what would happen now if aliens made contact? Whereas the Tardy Thompson book takes an extra level to push into the future. Although the very first alien contact was in 2012 in the Thompson book, if I remember correctly.
Yeah,
so
something like that. Yes.
But where the book is set, the two main stories, which the current story is in 2066, and the main backstory, there are some other intermissions or interludes between them, is in 2055. So the technology has progressed, things have progressed in part because of the alien contact. So that world of the Thompson book is much different to our world now. So you're processing two things. You're processing a medium future world, and you're also processing aliens. so yeah, whereas the Lagoon, I think, is not so interested in what will happen decades down the track after alien contact and how that will change humans and our technology and our society and our politics.
No,
it's
right.
About right now. It's at the beginning of that. And as you say, it's a much more, well, at least the spider entity is a much more optimistic, about.
Compare Lagoon as well to Who Fears Death, which is, and then the Book of the Phoenix from memory, which did you read?
I have not read that, no.
Okay. Which is far more pessimistic about how humans will deal with technology moving forward. You can even argue it's quite anti-science. I don't think that's the intent, but it does have that feel that Who Fears Death. Well, so Book of the Phoenix is the prequel. So with Book of the Phoenix, you understand how the Who Fears Death world has come about, where it's essentially post-apocalyptic and how that occurred, and there is an anti-science isn't the right way of putting it, but just that this idea that humans are prone to abusing technology, whether it's genetic editing or whatever, or psychic powers or whatever the hell it is,
mm-hmm.
and that can end in apocalypse. Whereas this is very, very, very different. That it really does try to put an optimistic sheen on the whole idea of first contact, which I found. That's why, again, I found it very interesting.
It does. I think underlying that, though, is possibly the same philosophy, because there is, well, it's more than the hint. I mean, the aliens kind of say we've come to not rule you, but we've come to kind of give you things which will help you, find peace, because you won't have as much scarcity of resources, because you won't have as much conflict over, just living stuff. So the idea is that we still actually need a benevolent, in this case, a fairly benevolent but firm, not ruler, but almost a parental aspect to the way the aliens are doing it. Because otherwise we're not going to sort it out ourselves.
Because the animals and the fishes get the same sort of equality, essentially. They're on the same
level
as
humans.
They're
all given, I guess, personhood.
Yes, everyone's given personhood.
Yeah, so, it's...
Okay, but I hear what you're saying.
So the idea is that actually,
we
can't do it ourselves. What we need is some much more enlightened entity to come down and say, okay, guys, we'll sort it out.
And Rosewater is exactly the same.
Yeah, but, in Rosewater, by the end, the aliens are not interested in saving the humans. Quite the opposite.
No, well, because they tried.
Did they? Was that really their purpose from the beginning? I don't think so. I think by the end, I'm pretty certain the aliens' purpose, maybe from the beginning, was their very slow and gentle colonization by organ transfer, in a way, and cell transfer, essentially.
Yeah, because we haven't really explained the plot of Rosewater.
So Rosewater, just because we are going to start talking about them together. So what's Rosewater about, Ian? Can't remember, can you?
No, I do. No, but you know, I'm bad at describing. Let me just, but I'll read the, what'd you call it, blurb shit? I'll read the blurb shit.
Read the blurb shit.
Okay. Rosewater by Tardo Thompson.
Oh, God.
Between meeting a boy who bursts into flames, alien floaters that want to devour him, and a butterfly woman who he has sex with when he enters the xenosphere, brilliant, Caro's life is far from the simple one he wants. But he left simple behind a long time ago when he was caught stealing and nearly killed by an angry mob. Now he works for a government agency called Section 45, and they want him to find a woman known as Bicycle Girl, and that's just the beginning. An alien entity lives beneath the ground, forming a biodome around which the city of Rosewater thrives. The citizens of Rosewater are enamored by the dome, hoping for a chance to meet the beings within or possibly be invited to come in themselves. But Caro isn't so enamored. He was in the biodome at one point, decided to leave it behind. When something begins killing off other sensitives like himself, Caro defies Section 45 to search for an answer, facing his past and coming to a realization about a horrifying future, which we're about to spoil now to tell you that that horrifying future is essentially that the aliens are taking over us by slow cellular
assimilation, I guess, in some way. Yes. Yeah, even though...
And part of that process was the fungus that leads to this xenosphere, which some people have access to and others don't.
So there are particulates in the air now that were released by the alien domes.
Yes. So the way they've done this, these sneaky little aliens.
Yes, they are sneaky.
Is the biodome in Rosewater, which is a name of irony, because especially when it was first established, when the biodome first was there, it smelt like shit because there wasn't proper sewerage. That's funny. is that the biodome opens at a particular time, or a hatch opens up in it? Not really a hatch, because it's more organic.
Yeah, it's
than
once
that.
A year.
Once a year, yep. And it cures people of their diseases, and also happens to resurrect the dead. Which
and also doesn't always cure people. It does. It corrects in the way it feels things should be corrected. So there are some people actually who, like, there's a woman who's got two mouths or something because she did, like, there are people who would deliberately self-mutilate.
Yes.
In the hopes of sort of engineering the way they might get healed, so they might get an additional limb or they might get...
Yes, as with everything in this book, nothing is straightforward.
Yeah. It's interesting that in both Lagoon and Rosewater, the ideas of the alien, one of the things the aliens will do is heal.
Yes.
Because they heal the president in Lagoon who's dying and other people. So this idea, I just find it profoundly interesting that in these two books, the main thing that humanity seems to want / get from the aliens is to be healed. Like, yeah, it's not weaponry, it's not superior knowledge, it's healing. Like, it's so interesting.
Because we fear mortality.
Yeah, but you know what I mean? Like, so many other alien books are about, like, the knowledge we'll give you, the weapons we'll give you.
No, but I think also in all, because we're generalising, not all alien invasion books, as you said before.
Hashtag.
Yes, hashtag. They also, there's always, yes, and that technology will remove any, you know, will remove the need to ever
be sick. But this isn't about, like, his technology that will heal. This is about the aliens themselves having healing powers directly.
Oh, okay.
You know what I mean? Okay, like, yeah, gotcha. It's quite fascinating that both these books have that as the major
theme. And how both the aliens in both these books, there's something organic and not overtly technological. They're not...
Yes, that's right. They haven't, like... in Rosewater, it's literally a biodome. It's not like a big spaceship or something. It's an organic thing that comes down. And in Lagoon, there is a ship, but as you say, it feels biological.
It's an extension of the alien that comes to shore.
Yeah, so they haven't come down in big metal and ships with lots of lights.
And I wonder partly whether that's sort of a cultural cringe to the old alien coming in a flying saucer And the idea that, you know, this idea of, not cultural cringe, but this idea that if you truly alien won't have this, an analog technology to us in that.
No.
And that's the other thing. No, yeah. the aliens in both these books, they're not anthropomorphized at. But they create a shape, and in Rosewater, both. But they choose that. That doesn't
mean
that
they inhabit a human shape.
But you didn't connect with Rosewater as well.
Intellectually, I found the ideas in Rosewater and the world building, especially, and the reveal, which I didn't ever pick. It was very well done. That in actual fact, all of the healing and all of this is actually the invasion. That's the invasion.
Yes.
That's it. It's not. It's not like it comes from the biodome, but the biodome and the interaction, the direct interaction there, that's not the invasion. The invasion is actually, the dome opening once a year and healing the people, and what is seen as a gift or just a byproduct that we're taking advantage of is the actual invasion. That is the actual taking over of Earth and humans.
And it's quite disturbing. Look, he is a cocky, arrogant shit, but that's deliberate, though.
I don't know. Well, he's a bit cocky and arrogant. It was more I don't know. The low-level sexism that ran through his entire character.
Yeah, and but he's constantly brought to account. He doesn't necessarily improve. He doesn't necessarily improve on that. But the relationship he has with Amanita, I think.
Yep.
I found really interesting because, first off, there's a couple of things. She has her own story, which we only get glimpses of. That that he is selfish enough to think is somehow connected to him, but has fuck all to do with him. Like her building blows up at one point, or the building she works in, and he thinks, "Oh, that must be because someone they're out to get me." No, it's got nothing to do with you.
Well, in most other narratives, it would be to do with that character,
but it doesn't. She's got her. She is her own story.
Yeah,
and in a sense, you sort of go, "Oh, I wish we had found out more. We had actually had her story rather than his, but that's fine." And also, she doesn't take his shit, and questions him on it all the time.
I'm not saying the book itself.
No, I know you're not saying that.
I'm saying his character, and I just was sick of him. And because it's a first-person narrative, and the whole book is him.
But are you tired of that sort of character generally, or is it
I really am, and I'm just, as I said, for me, it was just an unenjoyable way to spend a book, and not in a Patrick Bateman way. Like, not in an interesting way, not in a truly repulsive way. Not, you know, it was just like, oh, God. Like, every time he meets a woman, we know what her breast looks like. Like, every time he, didn't, unpleasant. And not in an interesting way or an engaging way for me. It was just like, oh, God,
because
this guy again.
He's in his first novel, Making Wolf, the narrator also is... has a very masculine point of view in that sense.
There's masculine,
but again,
I think that's a really simplistic way of characterizing it. There's like varieties of masculinity, and they don't all and shouldn't all involve immediately cataloging the women's breast size.
Well, okay.
Like every woman it was just always there, and I just can't. And you know, he's also, which again is acknowledged in the book. Like he's just very, his affect is very low. His levels of empathy are extremely low. And it's sort of built into his character, but it doesn't mean
Okay.
Like even the thing with the dog that goes all the way through the book, and that actually pissed me off.
Why?
Because animals always do, much more than the breast thing. Because that dog, like he keeps seeing it, it's hurt, and it's getting worse and worse and worse. He's like, oh, yeah, I should take it to the vet. Oh, and it's a stray dog. It's not his dog. But he says, like the first time we see the dog, he says, oh, this dog has adopted me, and I feed it, and it follows me home, and it's a stray dog. And then it gets a wound, and then the wound gets worse, and then it has maggots. And he only takes it to the vet when it's actually to his advantage to use that dog as an alibi.
Oh, I mean,
and it's like, oh, you're such an art. I just, like I said, it's like the character's well drawn for that. And it's all underlaid psychologically, I was just sick of it.
But I want to rant.
Go for it.
Because there's all this talk about how the more interesting characters are the ones that are flawed, and Caro is flawed, absolutely flawed.
He's flat. I don't think he is, though.
I think he's flawed. But this is what shits me. Mm. Well, you think it's a predictable flaw. It's the same old, same old.
Yeah.
He's a guy who doesn't have empathy for anyone or very little. He's only about himself.
Yep.
And when it comes to women, it's, yeah.
It's all about how beautiful they are or how sexy they are.
And we've seen this all before.
Yeah.
Yeah, I did not have the same reaction yeah. to that.
So that was...
I just saw there was a... because for me, if that was there without the commentary that runs through the book about him, not to say that he's particularly willing, because he's not going to change, fuck what other people yeah. say. I'd say, yeah.
Which
okay.
makes me, and that's what makes me doesn't care. Like, he doesn't actually care, and then I don't care. Like, honestly, it's like, dude, I rolled my eyes so many times. and like I said, I like flawed characters. I like characters who are not good people, all of that. But for me, I wasn't interested in this guy because this guy was another one of those guys. And for me, there wasn't that much interesting said about that particular character. I was really interested in the world building. I really loved the alien stuff. I loved the kind of quantum stuff that came through at the end.
And the thing with the bicycle girl?
Yeah. I really loved, yeah, as I said, the reveal about what the actual alien invasion was and the fact that it, you know, like at the end, they're going to win. They're absolutely going to win. There's nothing we can do. Like, the book says it's like climate change. It's like blah, blah, blah. It's just going to happen. We can't do it, anything about it, and we'll just have to see what happens, and it probably won't be good. But hopefully it won't happen in our lifetime.
You could argue then, well, so why should he bother to change?
Yeah, I know.
I mean, it's a first-person narrative, so he's recalling.
Yeah, dude, I'm not saying. Like, as I said, the character's well executed. I just don't give a shit. Like, and that's it. I'm not saying it was badly drawn. I'm not saying, you know, the character did stuff out of character and then didn't, and you know, none of that. The character's well drawn and his psychology is underpinned nicely. He's, for me, he was just flat and uninteresting. Mm. And I need, because it was a fairly long book. I don't know how long I've got the ebook, but Kindle told me the reading time was almost 6 hours. So it's a fairly long book. I mean, if I'm going to spend 6 hours of my life reading the book, I kind of need to be engaged with a bit more than just the ideas of the book a lot of the time. And especially when the point of view, the first person point of view character is just, as I said, it would, like, if he was actually repulsive, that might have made him interesting. For me, I just...
So he's a vanilla sort of misogyny, if you want to
put it... It's not even misogyny. Well, he does have... just sexism. Okay. Like, there's a difference.
Yeah, no, you're right. Okay.
It's not misogyny.
No, you're right. I will use the
like,
word.
Like, doesn't mean, but was misogyny.
Misogyny is used too often anyway. Yeah. It's a vanilla sort of sexism.
It is. And it's just like the thing with the dog and the thing... Like, it, yeah, I just... I don't know. I just got not even frustrated. As I said, just eye-rolly. And that was my... personal reaction to spending 6 hours with that character. And so I didn't engage with the book on an emotional level, but I did engage with the ideas of the book, which
okay,
I really,
so,
really liked.
So then I always ask, if you yeah. would you have stopped reading it if you hadn't have to do this podcast? And actually, I would say the same with Lagoon.
Lagoon, I wouldn't. And I wouldn't have stopped with Lagoon because I had read Who Fears Death and I really liked it. So I guess there was more trust in Acora 4
yep.
of where the book was going. And the writing is beautiful. I mean, it is beautiful, beautiful prose. So I probably would not have put that book down. And I am glad I read it because it was doing new things. And as I said, I can intellectually appreciate some aspects of a book while not necessarily emotionally really engaging with it.
Okay.
The best books for me do both, but it doesn't mean that I didn't like things about Lagoon and I am glad I read it. The Thompson, I might have skimmed a lot more than I did. Like, I didn't skim, but I might have, as I said, Kindle 6 hours, so I didn't skim. Because I was interested in the ideas. I was interested in where the alien stuff was going. I was much less interested, I guess, in the whole psychic stuff and the interiority and the building of avatars and all of that. Even though that was a response to how the alien presence was, I was less interested in that. I was much more interested in exactly what the aliens were and what they were doing
and what about the
and
whole,
how they were doing
what
it.
What about the whole S-45?
Yeah, so, well, again, because all of that was undercut with every time he saw Femi. She's the most beautiful woman in the world and she has the best breasts and I really want to fuck her. Like, for the 20 years he's in a professional relationship with woman, he still ends up at the very, like, yeah, at the very end of the current... Well, yeah, not 20 look, years, I guess.
I get it.
10, 12
but part
years.
Of that is played as a sort of... knee-jerk yeah, gag and you know between what? The two characters. But she's not necessarily complicit. I didn't say she's complicit.
Here's the thing. The book may play it as that. And where I was, every time I was in Femi's shoes, rolling my fucking eyes.
But she is, though. She's telling him to fuck off.
Yeah, I know. I know, but that's what I mean. Like, every time I'm just in her shoes going, but, yeah, she tells him to fuck off. Yeah, she doesn't put up with his shit. But she shouldn't have to put up with his shit. She shouldn't have to tell him to fuck off. She shouldn't have to roll her eyes every time.
But that's what fucking happens.
I know, and I'm saying...
You don't want to have to read that. I get that.
No, it's not that I don't want to have to read it. I'm saying that is why I didn't engage with the book. Because it's tawdry shit and I'm sick of it. To be honest, it's tawdry and I'm sick of it. And he was a flat, tawdry character. Well executed. I'm not saying the characterization was flat. The character was flat. He had very little empathy. He had very clear psychological drivers and all of that was well executed. As I said, I didn't give a shit. Maybe I'm just getting less tolerant of certain personality types in my middle age.
It's not about me not having read the book for 3 months and I can't provide a greater defense for Kara. I think this comes down to a subjective reaction.
Absolutely. My subjective experience...
Because I'm reading the book right now where the characters are. And I don't know when I'm finishing the book, but I am. I've only got 50 pages to go. But they are just shitting me off no end.
Yeah, and it's not a pleasant experience. It's not necessarily even a particularly unpleasant experience. It's just kind of like meh.
Yeah, see, because not that he's trying to mimic a Chandler or that sort of noir style, literary noir style. But that voice, and I see where you're coming from. Yeah. That voice to me, there's something not comfortable with it, but I'm aware of it and I understand it. And
yeah, I understand it.
And for me, what was interesting is where those other that voice is often. The hero is often not questioned on his actions. It's just that's how he is.
Yeah.
Here he is constantly taken down a peg. And that to me is what made him interesting.
Still, if you look at the book as a whole, he's not actually taken down a peg.
Well, he
ends up in this relationship with this beautiful, wonderful, sexy woman who completely tolerates his shit. Because she's got her own stuff that she's doing. He ends up...
You sort of wonder, though, if she didn't have office buildings exploding around her, whether she would just tell him to fuck off.
Maybe. But what I'm saying is, like, in terms
And remember, they're brought together because it's her sister.
But what I'm saying is, in terms of, like, step outside the book and look at the book, right? So step outside of the world of the book and just have a look at what the book gives this character. So at the end of the book... He's fine. He's got out of the job he hates. He's with this beautiful, wonderful, sexy woman who apparently adores him and asked him to move in with her and so on. He's even got the fucking dog that almost died because of him, but now he's fixed it. He's just sitting there quite comfortable in his apathy
and
quite
happy.
Next
few years.
To see what happens.
Everything.
You know what I mean? Like,
aliens will have taken over everyone.
The book has actually supported his life choices and given him what he wants. Right? Step outside the book. That's what's happened. Have a look at where the actors in the book have ended up, what they wanted, what they've been given. So structurally, does the book support him as a character when it gives him everything he wants and makes him happy at the end? Like, it's complicated. That's what I'm saying. It's because when you can always
like
justify anything in a particular book from within the book. You can always justify it, right? Unless the book is badly written and it makes no sense. But, right, because it's the book. It's how the character's feeling. Like, yes, look, he got told off by his boss a few times. His boss shouldn't have had to tell him off. You know what I mean? Like, it's – but the book itself is quite actually supportive of this character. Made me hold his hand for 6 hours with continual eye rolling. And that's what I mean. Every inner eye roll – I stepped one step away.
There's such a fatalism to the book because of what we know happens.
Yeah.
And so, yes, he's given his prize.
The whole book has fatal, but everyone's in that situation. It's not just him. Everyone is in the situation where humanity is fucked and who knows, we've got 10 years, we've got 100 years, who knows how long we've got, but not long and humanity's dead. Like, everyone, that's not just his situation. That's the view of the book. Within that rather pessimistic outcome, he's doing quite well.
Okay.
Right? And I'm not saying, as I said, this is, I'm not saying you can't be engaged with the book. You were.
And I found him funny too.
And I'm saying,
I found him funny because I love Thompson's dialogue.
There were funny bits in it.
I'm getting whiny again because I feel like I'm having to defend.
You don't have to defend.
Because I love this book.
You're engaged with the book.
It's one of my favourite books.
Yeah, but you don't have to defend that.
Well, no.
I'm not attacking that.
You don't have to do this podcast either. I mean, we could just sit here for 10 minutes and go,
Ian, Ian. What I'm saying is, you don't have to defend your position because I'm not attacking your position. I'm just saying what my position is. And the beautiful thing about subjective experiences of reading is everyone's position is accurate. You don't have to defend it.
Yeah, but you're also now reducing literary criticism.
Because the criticism part is separate. But you're saying you were really engaged with the book, and I'm saying I wasn't, and both those positions are true.
Okay, yes.
And that's
premise number one.
And I don't have to defend my lack of engagement any more than you have to defend your engagement.
Correct. Premise number yes, but we are doing a podcast where we are talking.
And then we move on to talking about why it happens. But at base, your actual engagement with the book isn't something you need to defend. You can talk about why you're engaged, but you don't have to do it defensively.
You can do it
in an explanatory manner.
Fine.
And that's all I'm saying. Yes, we criticise. Yes, we talk about why.
For you, the world building wouldn't have been strong enough in any other circumstance. The world building wouldn't have been strong enough.
I just found that character a low level and uninteresting level of irritation that, because it was such a long book and Amazon kept telling me, you've got 4 hours left, you've got 3.5 hours left, you've got 3 hours left. It's like, really?
This is the problem with these
books. I could watch Alien in like 90 minutes. I could watch that 4 times instead of reading this book. I would enjoy that a lot more. So I don't know. I might have skimmed a little because I was genuinely interested in the Alien.
Because it is actually, it's interesting because it's 100,000 words.
Yeah, so it's, you know.
It's long.
Yeah.
It's 350, 360 pages in actual physical form. It's 100,000 words. So it's not. Sure, but then Lagoon is about 75.
Yeah.
So
that extra 25% when you're
reading
a book that you're just not connecting with is a lot.
Yeah, and you're going to spend, if you're me, you're going to spend about 3 days with that character.
And I also found that the writing in Lagoon, like it's not just about word count, the writing in Lagoon was a lot more. No, but it is.
It's funny, we should say it's not just about word count.
It's not just about word count. No, it isn't, because the writing in Lagoon I found a lot, it was just a lot more, it was easy to read. The writing, not that the writing in the Thompson was bad, but it was a lot denser in terms of the information that you're being given rapid fire. And so it was a slower read because I'm having to assimilate a lot more information and new information and connect information, which is not a bad thing. It's just that made it a slower read than I would have read the Acora 4 in. So, it's the prose style. It's the amount of new data you have to rearrange in your head when you're reading. All of those things affect not just objectively how long it takes you to read the book, but also subjectively how long it feels it's taking you to read the book. Because our subjective experience of time isn't necessarily time.
Because I think we've bashed this to bits.
We've gone away a little bit, haven't we?
For me, with Rosewater, I thought it was, again, quite inventive. I do love how we have this, the bicycle girl, and just this, she's this weird Doctor Who-like character who pops in. Well, she is, because she is.
Not everything timey-wimey is Doctor Who.
No, but there's a certain, you know, anarchic.
I've watched a lot of Doctor Who, but I didn't. Nothing. The Doctor Who, you saying that now, that's the first time it's ever even occurred to me in conjunction with the book.
Okay.
So that might be more you than the book.
Possibly. Isn't that?
And I have watched a lot of Doctor Who, so it's not like it is a foreign thing to me.
Okay. So maybe
she was very stoic.
No, but there's an anarchic quality to her.
I think her anarchism actually is imposed upon her. She's not actually anarchic. She's very fixated on what she's curious about and what she wants to find out. I don't think she actually really gives much of a shit about the stuff going on outside of her. I can't remember the name of her conceptual city that moves around.
Well, maybe it's because she basically has a TARDIS.
She has a conceptual city, which is really cool.
Yeah, it is. It is very cool. I'm sorry. I'm reducing everything down to Doctor Who. I know.
Like she has this city which exists but never exists in any one particular place or time.
Yeah, it's like
it's fantastic.
It's Brigadoon, but
yeah, yeah. In a way, yeah, and okay. and people can immigrate into the city, and I guess also leave the city. But it's look, that I really liked. Like there was, as I said, there was a lot of intellectual stuff I really really liked about the book. If that would have been enough for me to keep wanting to hold the hand of that character as I found out about it, I don't know. Because I did find the and I know it was necessary for his background, but
all the stuff spent 10 years in the past.
Yes, all the 2055 stuff and how he got to be where he was. It's like, I don't know that I care that much.
That's where he's learning.
I know.
Okay.
I didn't care.
All right.
I would have been quite happy to have it pretty much all been the 2006 with a little bit of backstory dribbled in as well.
I liked, but see, that's the other thing I liked about it. I liked that it doesn't have a linear storyline, that it jumps around in time.
Yeah, I just didn't care about one of the storylines particularly
much. I enjoyed the structural, the way it doesn't... Okay. So, I also compare this to both these books, actually, to other genre that I read.
Yep.
And I love these books, character engagement aside... For the simple fact that not just, and even setting aside, for the simple fact that they are structurally inventive, that they're not just trying to tell a meat and potato A to B story, that they will either, as we said with the Lagoon, jump around in people's heads and fucking throw in, and we really haven't spoken about it, the god, the spider entity or the bone collector. I mean, you could argue, wait, Nettie, are you writing a fantasy novel or a science fiction novel? What the fuck is this? What is this? And there'll be people who will get upset with the whole taxonomy of that book. Where, you know, what is it? Is it science fiction? And I say, oh, who gives a fuck?
Mm.
It's a great deal of fun. And that set piece with the road and the people is cinematic. And, you know, fuck, let's make this into a movie today. Rosewater is
not... I think
not,
I'd see that movie.
Yeah, I'd be there. Yeah. I'd line up. So... Rosewater doesn't have the same sort of pyrotechnics in that sense, but it is innovative. And you could argue, well, people have jumped around in time.
I'm saying I don't know that it's that innovative to tell a front story and a back story and intercut them.
Well,
I think that the innovation comes with the ideas of this book and how they're presented. I don't necessarily think
structurally. No, but you just said it, how they're presented. But it could easily have been presented as A, B, C and D, but we...
Yeah, but I don't think there's any... Yeah, I know what you mean, but I'm just saying, I don't mean presented as in a non-linear way.
Okay, I accept the fact that my bar on this is fucking low. Very low, because read any literary novel and, you know, they do that. They do what Tade does in this book as a matter of course.
Yeah, but I don't think the back and forth between two stories in two separate times, especially by a single narrator. Like, essentially, here's our story now, 2066. Did appreciate the flagging at the beginning of chapters, which I did actually read this time. Thank you. The chapter was dated, so that was good. And I did actually read them because I needed to. But I don't particularly think that here's our front story set now, here's our back story set a dozen years earlier, and we'll intercut them. That's a very conventional technique, actually, to storytelling.
No, but he does more than that, though. It isn't just...
And the little interludes.
But that's the thing. But that is it. That's the flavour.
Yes.
It isn't just 2055 and 2066. And you're right, if it was just jumping between those two. But he goes to 2042. He goes back to London and explains what... It moves in a way that...
He doesn't go back to London. We get told about
okay,
that,
but it's right. It's all told. Yes. You're right. You're 100% correct. Yep. He doesn't, because it's all...
But that's what I mean. I think that's really well handled, and it cut up the narrative.
But there isn't the way he lines. You don't know how well. Again, low bar, I agree. But, and a lot of these genre novels, you go, oh, we're going to do this is the 2066 chapter, and then the next chapter is going to be in the past and forward. But here, it feels... And there's different... It's interesting.
No, it is interesting.
It keeps you on your feet.
I'm just saying, I think the inventive part of the book
and
was...
And assuming you like the character, which
the
you didn't...
And you know what's really... I was just, as we were talking before, I just had an idea that thought maybe actually the problem was that I identified too much with the character, and because he actually didn't give a shit, neither did I. It's like, you don't care? Then I don't care.
He cares about...
Maybe that was part of it.
He cares about his girlfriend. Like when he thinks she's dead...
Yeah, but that's like quite a long way in the... You know what I mean? So maybe that was actually part of it.
Did you roll your eyes when you thought, oh, the girl's dead?
Well, I had a double layer. I went, okay, so if he's fridged her, I'm going to hate this book. But I bet he hasn't fridged her. He's just making me think he's fridged her. But then I know she's not freed, so then there's no suspense. So it was like, it was, and all that happened in like 5 seconds.
Okay.
Because it was like, oh, if he's fridged her.
I will say that he does pull off the same trick. Well, he uses the, yeah. Well, no. So that's the thing. This is him repeating the same trick he used in Making Wolf, where you, yeah. you think
because then you go, well, has he fridged her? But oh no, I bet he hasn't, because you know that's so common. So he hasn't, but he know. But then oh, but what if he's double bluffing? So he really has fridged her, but then I'll still be mad because he's fridged her. So it was this sort of psychological. Acrobatic act I did.
This, the torturing that occurred with this book.
But yeah, but no, as I said, I wonder if that was it. I wonder if the character was just so non-caring about just about everything throughout most of the book that that's actually what infected me. It was like, because really, if he doesn't care, why should I care?
Okay, you're right. You
so
are
I,
right.
I don't know. I don't
you
know.
Are right that I've set a very low bar structurally with this book. Yeah. But I still think it's that in,
it is
in
well
addition
done.
With, as we've now discussed to death, the world building, the fungus, the xenosphere. And
the fact that they have to put antifungal cream all over themselves to take a break from hearing people's thoughts all the time.
But I do love that his job at the start of the book, it's his sort of... fake job because he's really working for this department.
He's really working for a secret government agent. Well, the agency isn't secret, but his role in it is.
Yes. But his job is to act as a firewall.
Yeah.
For banks because this sort of Jungian unconsciousness or whatever it is.
Well, it's a xenosphere. It's the particles, the biological particles in the air that allow people. Some people. There's a small section of humanity who become what are called sensitives, and essentially they're psychics. They're actual real psychics now because they can read other thoughts via the particulates.
Oh, no, I just love that. What I found funny is that the book actually opens up as a sort of office narrative. It's just it's just this,
and it was really cool.
We're going to work. Got to
sit there and read all of Virgil.
Yes, exactly. That's how they block people. They read the words from
long works of literature over and over, so that. People can't kind of get no. I look as I said there was like and the opening was really cool.
The what? Sorry.
The opening was really cool. It hooked me. So yeah. There was.
But then you get to know Kara.
Then you get to know Kara, and it's like, dude.
And Ian thought, I love this guy.
Shut up.
Kirsten said, I
did the only thing that kept niggling at me from the world building, I guess, logic perspective was I did question how. He mentioned it once that he had to try quite hard not to read Amanita's thoughts when he first met her, and he didn't want to because he liked her and something might happen, and he wanted a relationship to actually develop, I guess, consensually in terms of what information is revealed to both parties.
Yep.
But that was kind of just mentioned once, and then it did niggle on me as the book went on, and their relationship got closer and they got more intimate.
As to how he's blocking her.
As to how he was like how easy that should have been for him to be blocking when he's doing a whole bunch of other stuff. And he would say from time to time that, you know, thoughts would, like if he lost concentration, thoughts would just intrude. So that I thought could have been played with a little more, and it might have been a bit more interesting actually to occasionally get a thought from Amanita that he hadn't expected or something. And then he was like, oh, no, I don't want to. So that kind of got pushed to the side of the table rather quickly, and it was something which just niggled at me from time to time. It's like, shouldn't he really be involuntarily reading her mind a little bit more often? But I guess if she's actually some kind of a spy or agent, maybe she's got a really good firewall herself set up, but then maybe he should be questioning that. I don't know. It was just a little thing that did niggle. But
your niggles?
My niggles.
They are... Niggle-tastic.
I can't help it. They just sit there in the back of my mind sometimes going, shouldn't he be reading her thoughts now? Like, is he that controlled? Like, even in the middle of sex, even in the middle of orgasm, he's that controlled over his ability to
well, what about the cream?
That things just don't come through?
Maybe the fungal cream.
No, he said, like, when they're having sex, the cream wears off because it rubs and sweat. And like, see, this is what I mean. It's like that. I just think there's more that could have been done with that. But there's so much in this novel already. That is just a tiny little thing.
One thing we haven't mentioned is Rosewater itself, the place.
Yeah, so, well, that was where the biodome landed and stayed. And so this town grew up around the biodome. And I guess it grew up, first it was, I guess, a quasi-military base. Yep. And then there would have been people coming in to
and then
both
they realized
serve
they had
that,
to
but also
build
to
build sewage into it.
Yep. And now it's become this quite. Populous and vibrant city. Where zombies walk.
Because we have forgotten the zombies.
Yeah, so these reanimates.
And that's one of the things that I did really like, that he goes to his house or apartment and just in the background. Well, actually, he has to shoot one that's nearby, but near his apartment. But, you know, you'll hear the rat-a-tat-tat of machine guns as when the biodome opens, because that's when the zombies are...
They're there all year. It's just that they're en masse when the biodome opens, because that's when corpses get reanimated. And we also haven't said that what Kara's, I guess, what his superpower, because this is kind of... Is that he's one of the sensitive, but he's like the best sensitive ever. No, he is, right?
Well, he's the last to die in a sense.
Well, he's also the best. Like in his school, he's the most. He's not the best pupil in terms of his ability to be studious, but he's
got,
the most
he's
powerful.
Got the raw talent.
Right. So he's the best sensitive ever. His special gift is that he can find things that have been lost.
Oh, yes. Oh, shit. I can't believe we didn't
So that's how he ends up getting embroiled in S-45?
S-45, and that's how he can find Bicycle Girl because he can find
He's able to find things that have been physically lost by a human being because there needs to be a thread he can follow.
Yes, but which again,
there's so many ideas in this.
No, but again, comes back to possibly the tone of the book and what you didn't like because finding things is what detectives do in noir fiction, whether they're finding wives or... Have you read any Chandler?
I have.
They're finding
Chandler.
Things and there is a similar tone.
Can we just... We've gone over this. This is all fine. You don't need to defend. I am not going to go, of course. Oh, the tone. I'm so engaged now. Like, I understand it all on an intellectual
basis. I've got one question
yes,
for you.
Okay.
Am I gaslighting right now? Is this gaslighting? Have I gaslit? Because I made a judgment as well. Because I said, you're not meant to make a judgment, are you?
No, I don't think you were actually questioning how I felt about the book. You were just trying to defend yourself as to why you didn't feel that way.
Now I'm questioning how I'm saying that. Kirsten,
but are you sure
you didn't misunderstand it? Because clearly it's got antecedents with Chandler and, you know, well, not
he's understanding gaslighting.
I don't know why I'm just...
No, now you're just being patronising.
Yeah. Oh. So gaslighting can move to patronising.
Yeah. It can possibly be both, but I think you're mostly just patronising.
Can I just... Considering we're slightly getting to the end of the podcast, I don't know why I threw the word slightly. We get to the end of the podcast and moving not away from the books. Yes, we are. Do you know what got nominated for? Well, got longlisted for the Tiptree?
I haven't actually had a look at that yet.
Well, it's actually on the honor list. So you know how the Tiptree has a winner, honor list, and then long list.
Yep.
It's on the honor list. Core of the Sun, and I'm pretty sure I said last podcast. Do you think this would be worthy of Tiptree?
And I'm pretty sure
you said, you've got to be kidding.
I'm pretty sure, Ian, what I actually said.
I don't really listen to the podcast.
Which you would know if you went back and listened to them.
I don't bother doing that.
Was that I wouldn't be at all surprised or indeed upset if it got the honour list on the Tiptrees. And I said if it won, I would reserve judgment to see what else was possibly eligible.
I don't think you said any of those things.
Listeners,
but then clearly
feedback,
your lack of engagement with Rosewater shows where
I don't deserve to read books.
So is there anything else you wanted to say about these two novels? Because I think, you know, we haven't said a lot about Nigeria itself, but I think they're both...
I don't think we need to. It's the setting of the books.
Okay, yes.
No, I mean we did talk about it at the beginning. I mean, it's not like if these two books were set in California, we'd spend a whole lot of time talking about California.
That's interesting, isn't it? Just on that. No, really, that is the thing. When us whiteys read books like this, we feel an obligation to really get stuck into the setting of the place.
Yeah, and it's not an imaginary place.
Yeah.
It's not like this is...
No, but we treat it that way.
Yeah, but it's like, not like it's another world that has been made up and we're talking about the world building because this is
no,
fantasy
but
essentially world or
might as well
planet.
Be because, you know, because we've never been there and it's... and they're so evocatively illustrated because you're...
How would you know, though? Because you've never been there.
Never been there, yeah. I've only been to California a couple of times, so it's not like... Okay, anyway.
I am glad I read Lagoon. I am glad enough that I read Rosewater just because I did find all of the alien stuff and the ideas behind that really, really interesting.
I think they're both fantastic novels.
You're allowed to think that.
I don't. That's
Well, that was a bit patronising.
That's terrible. I think they're both fantastic novels, and I will stand by them and defend them, clearly, for the last I shouldn't really defend the Acorafor because you didn't really come up with a reason that I find worthwhile to discuss.
You know what I find actually really fascinating talking to you over these years? I actually think a lot of the time it's your own insecurity as a reader that comes through, because it's like if someone says, yeah, I didn't quite like that book you loved, it's like, oh my God, what's wrong with me? Why did I like it? Is my opinion good?
Isn't everyone like that, though?
Shouldn't I just defend it?
Okay. Isn't everyone like that? Because that is what creates the internet. I mean, we wouldn't have flame wars and shit on the internet.
There is, but
and my insecurities are at least being vocalised on a podcast and not in some sort of bizarre Twitter storm thing.
But what I'm saying is,
I think we're all very insecure about our own taste.
But I don't think you need to be insecure as a reader.
Of any consumer of any pop culture or whatever it is.
But what I'm saying to you is, so I've told you I didn't like these books, and here's some of my reasons why that I can articulate, and I'm not insecure about that. Like, you don't have to be insecure.
No, it's the opposite, wouldn't it be? If one of those books you loved and I'd said it was a pile of shit, that's when you don't feel... You don't, though. I know. So
no, I don't.
That question. And I don't know if that's a...
you're a smart person.
I don't want to get on the therapy couch now.
No, but I'm just saying, you're a critical reader. You don't need to be insecure about... You know, like
There is a dynamic. I really do believe this. There is a dynamic that, you know, because I do think you're extremely smart, and you do say a lot of smart things on this podcast. And so, yes, if it was, and this is where it gets really rude, but if it was, I'm not going to put names, but if it was someone whose
opinion you didn't respect,
frankly, yes,
then you would not be insecure if they didn't like something.
I would just shrug it off.
Yeah, yeah.
So I'm just thinking you don't respect my opinion, therefore you shrug my. Views. Oh,
yeah, no, you really, every month you leave, I think, fucking hell, how could he have liked that book? Is he just an idiot? Oh my God, give me a gin and tonic.
Is he just
what
idiot?
Tripe am I going to have to read next month that he thinks is amazing?
Yeah, there's a reason why we don't recommend books to each other anymore, because I can't stand the shit he would dole up as examples of good literature.
I just find it interesting, and I am
insecure about it.
And I'm saying that you don't need to be so
I am insecure, and I really do get ultra insecure when people who I think are very smart don't like something that I think is incredible. I just don't get, because it just bugs me.
I know it's funny.
But I
find it extremely interesting. It's like, that person who I really respect and who likes a lot of things that I do really likes this book that I hate. That's interesting. Like, I find it deeply interesting.
I think at the end of the day, if you're like me, that is, if you're Ian Mond, you just assume everyone agrees with you.
Yeah.
Let's be honest. It's an ego thing. It's 100% an ego thing.
That's one of the deeply underlying problems of humanity.
Yes.
Yeah. Everyone is like me.
Absolutely.
And then we'll take another step and say, if you're not like me, maybe you're not really human.
Yeah. Okay. I didn't really want to get into that.
I'm not saying you think that. I'm saying this is how these things begin.
But that's
everyone
why I'm
is
talking
like
to you, because it makes me reevaluate. Although I'm not going to reevaluate Rosewater, because I
genuinely
didn't
have to.
No, but I have reevaluated some of the other books we've spoken about, like Core of the Sun. I actually reevaluated while we were talking about it on the podcast.
Well, look, here's the difference between these two books and Core of the Sun for me is that, as I said, it was just a matter of engagement, and there were various reasons from you know, stylistic choices of the authors, which are not bad choices. They just didn't gel with me, you know, all that sort of stuff. And that's different to another book where I actually have deeply held philosophical issues with the book itself and what the book might be saying or trying to say or not saying well or saying inadvertently. And that's the difference there.
Because it's interesting, and we're talking about a book that we spoke about last month, but with Core of the Sun, it's now on the Shadow Clerk. You know how they're doing a Shadow Clerk of the Clerk Wards? They've pumped it up there as a book that should be on the plonked it up there.
It's fine.
No, it's interesting that it's getting quite a lot of, just right now, just after we've spoken about it, it's getting quite a bit of traction.
Oh, is it us?
No, it's got zero to do with us. It's just one of those things where we talk about something
also,
and suddenly you see it everywhere. What the fuck? No one spoke about this thing for, you know, it came out in January 2016. No one spoke about it for 12 months and now suddenly.
Well, now 2016 award shortlists are beginning to be announced.
Yeah, true. And when I say no one spoke about it, no one that I give a shit about spoke about it. There were probably millions of people.
So part of it might be the red car phenomenon.
Yeah, true.
But part of it is also that right now is when all of the shortlists and mentions for awards for books published in 2016 are coming out.
And we should say Lagoon did get...
And I'm not surprised that that book has gotten
We should say Lagoon got... I don't know if it won anything, but it definitely got nominated for stuff. There you go. It definitely got on the Kitschies, I remember that.
Mm-hmm.
And Rosewater could be nominated for stuff, but hasn't actually appeared on...
That's a really downbeat way
I know, sorry, sorry. But it should be, though.
It should, yeah, look, I...
Well, no, you can't, don't say it should be.
As I said...
Get away from
for fuck's sake. I can intellectually appreciate a book, and that is separate to emotionally engaging, and that is separate to acknowledging that my lack of emotional engagement doesn't mean that other people won't be heavily invested in the book on an emotional level. And I think you have to get to a point where you can separate what things might be, not objective, because objective is a difficult word, but what things might be problematic about a book across the span and what things are problematic for me, Kirsten, as a reader, which doesn't necessarily mean the book is good or bad.
I am typical of what is on the internet, because think of how many Flame Wars race failed. Just pick a man. Wouldn't have happened if people have just said, oh, okay, yeah. Well, that's a fair point.
I know. It's like, yeah,
fair enough.
I didn't really...
Just using the two words, fair enough.
I know, but, you know, it's like, well, yeah, I didn't really engage with this book. Fucking die, bitch! All right. It's like, but you're right. Often that is the level it gets to.
Next month we'll continue my journey of insecurity.
Why? Oh, right. Okay, different type of insecurity.
No, no. We're going to discuss two books. I may like both of them. You may not. And I'll be insecure about it. I mean, I think this podcast is just Ian's journey of insecurity. We've had 60. It's really nothing to do with you. It's got 60 episodes of mine.
I'm sad that your
character. No,
no, no. I'm just saying I'm sad your character arc hasn't progressed over the.
Yeah, it hasn't, has it, really? No.
Over the.
No,
what,
no. If you're in
so.
My head for this whole 60 podcasts, you'd go, fuck this. I can only engage with this guy. Yeah. All he's just
sad.
Shit. Sad. by the way, just slightly.
Yes.
There's a guy called Simon Savage.
Yeah, I know. Yeah, well, I don't know Simon, but
he's got a great YouTube.
Yes,
channel.
I listen. I haven't for a while because I've been behind in all my podcasts. But he does the Reader's Podcast.
Yes, he does. Yes. But he also has a great YouTube channel, which is 15 minutes.
Oh, okay. I didn't know that. I must look that up.
Book calls, and he does. He has a little interim thing where he has he's having a cup of tea and just chatting.
Oh, it's excellent!
Really
no,
entertaining.
Yeah, no, Simon's great. I used to listen to the Readers all the time, and then my podcast carousel just expanded exponentially, and now Professor Brian Cox has a podcast, so that's kicked a few people off. Sorry.
Whereas I just listen to Gimlet Media podcasts.
In your little walled garden.
So next episode.
What are we doing next episode, Ian?
In episode 61 of my therapist. You're my therapist.
Oh,
that's
dear.
What you are. We're going to be doing Australian, what you've put in, Aussie Lit Spec Fic.
I didn't put it in that voice.
Looks like it.
Okay.
And those books are a book that I have been meaning to read forever.
Me too.
Because it came out in 2013.
So finally.
Came out in 2013.
It's on the fucking list. It is a thick book, I'll warn you.
Yeah, I know it is.
It's pretty big.
I bought it already.
Right.
I've got the fucker.
Okay.
Actually, I think I already had the fucker.
Right. What is the fucker? This is awful. I'm so sorry, Alexis Wright.
Well, I've just given that away. It's The Swan Book by Alexis Wright.
Yes.
And I'll be honest, did not know that Alexis was Australian.
Oh, right. Very bad. It's called The Swan Book. It's got a big black swan on the cover.
Why would that? Why? Are there no swans in any other country
Not
in the world?
Not black ones.
Really? Black swans are unique to Australia?
Yep.
Christ, I know nothing about this country.
Totally unique.
Here I am rabbiting about Nigeria and I barely anything about
swans
Australia.
Swans in the Northern Hemisphere are white and mute, I believe. And we have the black swans, which are definitely not mute.
Yeah, well, that's true. But I just thought they were... I've seen them. It's not like I haven't seen the swan. I just haven't... Anyway.
You didn't think they were only... They're only ours. We're very special.
And New Zealand? Do they have them too?
That I don't know.
See, they may not
New Zealand only... listeners. Feedback. We want to know if you have swans and if they're black. I suspect if you have swans, they will be
Actually,
black.
Seriously,
but do you
can
have
you
swans?
Seriously, fucking provide feedback because we're doing an episode about the Swan Book and we want to be able to talk about it, all right?
You could always just in the next month research about the black swans in New Zealand if you wanted to.
Oh, fuck yes, I could do that too.
Yeah. Anyway, what's the other book?
I don't know why we're drawing this out. Crossfire. I mean, the podcast
deep
is
breath,
too long.
Deep breath.
Crossroads of Canopy by Thoreau Dyer, which is a book I was going to read in January when it came out, but then you said, hey, we should do it for the podcast.
We should.
Which we're going to. So I've not done it. So because I didn't want to have read it in January, then be like I am now with these two books and have to recall.
Good idea, Ian.
Important plot points.
But you should start reading the Swan book now. Because it's
not that long. I saw how many words. It's not that long. It's I can knock it off in 4 days.
Okay. Well, I've got the.
It's not like 250,000 words.
Have you
words.
Got a physical copy?
No, I've got an e-book. Okay. I bought the iOS book.
Maybe that my physical copy just has big margins or larger print or something because it's a brick of a book.
Yeah, okay.
My copy.
It's so. No Kim Stanley Robinson's 2140. That's,
I don't think, yeah.
That's over 200,000 words. Yeah. Do you know Ken Liu's second book, The Wall of Storms, nearly 300,000 words.
Oh, yeah, another book I won't
and
read.
And Paul Auster. 4321, which is what came out in January and potentially will be up for awards later this year, nearly 400,000 words.
Just stop it. Stop it. Stop it. What are you guys doing? Stop it. Some of us don't have a month to read a book and only one book.
I know. It's a
jeez. I seriously find it, I just don't, if it's a really big book, it's like I'm never going
to
read you.
Look, Rosewater was really just over 100, but I see no reason why a book has to be longer than 90,000 words. If you can't say what you have to say, 90,000 words.
Let's go back to the 70s. Let's have
there were big books
60 to 70,000 word
there
books.
There were big books in the 70s.
Of course there were. I didn't read them.
I mean, isn't you what?
Can I just say, all the books I read in the 70s, really thin. most of them had pictures.
please send feedback. By commenting at the website, writerandcritic.podbean.com. This episode really is just, I don't know, it's been a crazy one.
Yeah.
It's sending an email to my therapist, no, sorry, to writerandcritic@gmail.com, or you can follow @writerandcritic on Twitter and sponsor us on Patreon if you can. This really started off like a normal garden variety episode 60 of a podcast, and it just became.
And can I just say? Speaking of Patreon, I would like to thank our newest patron.
Oh, we got a new one.
Lorena.
Oh, hi, Lorena.
Thank you very much. We love you and we appreciate your support.
Oh, thanks a lot. That's amazing.
And also, I've actually been meaning to say this for a couple of months and I don't know how effective it will be, but I don't want to release names because of privacy stuff, but one of our patrons who had the special Kirsten Makes a Thing level,
yeah.
I made them a thing and I sent it to the address they gave me like just after I made the thing and it came back and they haven't replied to emails. So if for some reason your email account died and you didn't get the thing, you know who you are. I hope you're okay and please get in touch with us so I can resend your thing. But I hope you're okay is the big thing.
Okay. So on that note.
Because I can't get in touch with them. I've tried and nothing.
This has been one of the great episodes.
It has been a lot of fun.
And
this is actually what happens when we have books we don't quite agree on. If we both love the book, it's like, yay, book! Yes, book!
I will never forget those 2 months we did self-published books.
Oh, books we both don't agree on, they're no fun either. But, you know, when one of us...
Yes.
That didn't make sense. We both don't agree on. Books we both don't like.
Yes.
They're no fun.
Do you remember that self-published...
Oh,
do you remember the feedback we got from one of the...
two episodes.
Do you remember the feedback we got from one of the...
I do. We don't need to go into that. But no, books where we have a difference of opinion, they actually make the best episodes.
Okay. On that note... It's been fun. Bye.
It's been fun. See you. Don't tell me how to produce.
Yeah.
I don't tell you how to
what? Exactly.
Talk.